You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 100.5 FM.
A new book challenges the idea that development NGOs, or non-governmental organizations, working in the Global South, help people there to achieve meaningful and just development. Paved with good intentions, Canada's development NGOs, from idealism to imperialism, argues that, contrary to many expectations, NGOs have not offered an alternative to the reigning development orthodoxy or acted to empower the poor. Nicholas Barry Shaw is co-author with Drew Ojeje of the book. He's an independent researcher living in Montreal, and he's a member of Haiti Action Montreal and the Canada Haiti Action Network. And Nick Barry Shaw joins me this morning from Winnipeg. Hello, Nick.
Hi.
So why did you decide to write this book?
It really started out of, it grew out of my implication as a Haiti solidarity activist. Myself and I think a lot of other people across Canada in late 2003, early 2004 started researching what was happening in Haiti because it was pretty clear that, there was a lot of conflict going on in that country, and we discovered that Canada was really deeply involved. There was a coup d'etat that happened in February 2004. And, while the United States sent troops there and whisked the democratically elected president out of the country on a State Department plane, there were Canadian troops on the ground securing the airport. And so Canadian troops participated in the occupation of the country afterwards. And really, the whole Canadian state was involved in kind of putting through this undemocratic coup d'etat and participating in supporting the really violent repression of supporters of the elected government afterwards. And so we, as activists, were researching and trying to get the word out about what was happening. And we started looking to, who would be our natural allies, which we expected would be NGOs, development NGOs, amongst others. And when we turned to look at, to see what their position was and to contact them to try to find some support for the work we were doing, we really hit a brick wall. And we didn't really understand that at first, and then we started looking into a little more where these organizations were coming from, and we learned that they were getting, millions of dollars for work in Haiti after the coup from the Canadian government through the Canadian International Development Agency. And so it was really that insight, that realization that, oh, wow, these development NGOs, non-governmental organizations are really not that non-governmental. And so the book started from there.
Well, let's take the story back to the 1980s. What sparked the boom, as you call it, of NGOs in the Global South?
Yeah, so that's one thing we talk about in the book, the NGO boom, this idea that, prior to the 1980s, NGOs were really a marginal kind of phenomenon in the development world and in the third world more generally. And then after the 1980s, you see this huge explosion in numbers and in resources, development resources controlled by NGOs. And that really was tied up with the rise of neoliberalism, with structural adjustment, and with the debt crisis that was happening around at that time. Basically, what was happening was Canada and other Western countries were imposing these really onerous kind of reforms, economic reforms on these countries, opening them up to corporate interests, and at the same time demanding that these countries cut back social spending and kind of basically shift resources away from the poor and towards capital. And at the same time, there was a lot of, predictably, a lot of opposition to this agenda. There were, huge protests in many different countries. There was really a wave of protests throughout the Global South against these policies, and there was a dawning realization on the part of foreign policymakers that they had to do something about this. And what they did about it was they started funding NGOs. And it was sort of through this haphazard process that they kind of discovered that NGOs could actually be very useful at kind of calming, this discontent and establishing a form of decentralized political control on the ground, kind of reaching down into the grassroots, into the barrios, and into the poor neighborhoods and as a way of kind of getting control over the situation. And that's a side of NGOs that I think most people don't understand.
So it's as if we give a, if we can imagine something like that happening in Canada, that our public health care system is completely defunded so that poor people don't get health care, and then some non-governmental organization comes in from another country and starts providing that health care.
Yeah, it's very similar to that. And it's even, I would say the parallel is even more direct in some ways, in the sense that in the 70s and in the 80s, I know in Quebec and I think in other places, you know, radical groups, left groups, were doing things like setting up community clinics, setting up community centers, and kind of agitating for, you know, better services for the local population. And one of the things the state did in with respect to these groups, which eventually evolved into community groups, was it extended funding to them. You know, and so that funding, on the one hand, you know, did mean they could provide more services, but on the other hand, it also came with strings attached. And those strings generally meant kind of cutting off that charitable work or that kind of palliative social work from any kind of political critique of the status quo, any kind of challenge to the existing order. And so that happened within Canada. I think it happened pretty much across the country with respect to community groups that once had ties to the left. And it happened in many countries, in Haiti and other places, where, you know, the introduction of foreign funding for local groups kind of led to a process of NGOization, and it led to a process of de-radicalization and depoliticization.
So if we look at an organization, for example, like CUSO in the 1960s, which was a radical kind of an NGO, then they lost their ability to take a radical approach to development partnership. Was that all through their funding being taken over and then their agenda being, I guess, de-radicalized?
Yeah, well, CUSO is an interesting example because it kind of demonstrates the different history of NGOs. We spend a lot of time talking about it in the book. And, you know, CUSO started out as really a project of the Canadian government. You know, the first setting up of the organization really depended on political connections of the founders with Lester B. Pearson and other members of the Liberal Party who were in power. They got huge amounts of funding from the beginning. And the creation of CUSO, this volunteer-sending organization, they would send, you know, volunteers to work in schools and in hospitals in the Third World. The idea was really to contribute to the fight against communism. This is how Pearson and other people and the founders of CUSO themselves really saw the mission. It didn't turn out that way. The organization kind of got commandeered by the kind of the upsurge of youth radicalism in the late 60s and 70s. I think it's an interesting example because it really demonstrates the limits of how far you can go in an NGO, because CUSO was receiving 90% of its funding from the Canadian government, from CETA, throughout those years. And as the government became more and more irritated with its stand on issues like Palestine, its criticism of the Canadian government's role in Chile after the coup in 1973, Canada's ties with apartheid, South Africa, and so on, they became more and more irritated, began placing more and more controls on the funding that CUSO was receiving, and then finally, in 1979, they cut off all funding to the organization, and they swept away its elected board of directors, and they replaced it with a bunch of hand-picked representatives who were more ideologically in line with what they wanted, and really transformed the organization. And so, for me, it's kind of a cautionary tale, the idea that, you know, people can go into development NGOs and rely on government funding and still challenge the status quo is really a dangerous illusion, I would say.
No, you say that Canadian development NGOs played a divisive role in the anti-globalization movement of the late 1990s. Why do you say that?
This is one of the interesting things that we found doing the research. My impression as a participant in the anti-globalization research, and I think it's common to a lot of people, is that, you know, NGOs, development NGOs, were part of this broad kind of global civil society, this kind of broad protest movement against trade free trade agreements like the FTAA and NAFTA and so on. But looking at it more closely, what you can see happening from the APEC summit onward in 96, which was held, the protests were held in, I believe it was 97 in Vancouver, is the government, we cite like internal documents with Lloyd Axworthy and other people kind of discussing this, and they're basically saying, well, we'll fund the NGOs, we'll fund the more respectable kind of figures of dissent, they'll hold people's summits, which we'll pay for, and, they'll get to submit some recommendations to us, and we'll maybe, throw in some social clauses, window dressing, to these agreements so that the opposition to the free trade agenda will kind of dissipate. And I think that's something that wasn't really understood, what was going on at the time, and I don't think it was understood in part because people didn't realize to what degree NGOs were vulnerable to that pressure from the government because of the funding relationship. And so the government was really able to exploit that, and they would, present themselves as being against the status quo, but at the same time work to, dissociate protests from, more direct action kind of style of tactics and a more broad kind of rejection of the free trade, corporate free trade agenda as such, towards, kind of limited palliatives, side agreements, and things like that that didn't fundamentally challenge the neoliberal agenda.
Many of us, of course, want to support progressive work in the global south. If we want to do that, how can we assess whether an NGO is a positive force in a developing nation that they're working in?
Yeah, I don't think there's any easy answer. I guess the shortest answer is to, look to support organizations that don't take funding from CETA. Those are really the organizations that need the most support. And then beyond that, you need to assess like whether an organization is truly representative of the people it claims to represent, and whether it has a connection to to a political base, to a social base. There's no other way to do it than to do a bit of research and to get to know these organizations. But I think the corrosive effect of CETA funding should really lead us to steer clear of working with organizations that take funding from the government.
Well, it's been really great to talk to you this morning, Nick.
All right. Thanks for having me on, Jane.
Thanks so much. I've been speaking with Nick Barry Shaw. His book, Paved with Good Intentions, was co-authored with Drew Ojajay, and they have a website called pavedwithgoodintentions.ca, so you can also check that out if you're interested.